Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 188, Friends, Gurus, and Fierce Deities.
There's a funny thing about the Tibetan Book of Natural Liberation, Book of the Dead, which is that it was said to have been brought to Tibet in the 8th century and then was rediscovered in the 14th century and was not available for the use of the Tibetan people besides some adepts for 700 years, therefore, or 600 years. And I reflected about that and about the denial of death in our society. And I had like a eureka moment. And the reason that death is forcibly denied in cultures, in the case of Tibet of that ancient time, it was due to militarism, I believe. And because it wasn't industrial, that was sort of the industry of imperial Tibet. And it took a long time to wean the culture off of that because of, due to the influence of Buddhism. And in our case, it's a combination of militarism and industrialism, both. Because if you take Kubler-Ross's great statement that in the many thousands of people she'd been with at death, not a single one regretted not spending another day at the office. If you connect that, then a society's sort of official ideology doesn't want people thinking about death, who they want to either risk their lives or give up their lives to fight somebody, or work slave away in some industrial productivity enforced, like you do nothing if you don't produce, culture. Because once people start thinking about the death, they start thinking about, well, what's the meaning of my life? And what am I doing with it? And should I really be just Charlie Chaplin in modern times, like a cog in the wheel? Or should I be doing something to fulfill my potential? So they start resisting sort of collectivist outlook, you know, that you need for militarism. You need people to be willing to throw their life away for the boss's, you know, wish to conquer a few oil wells or some nonsense, which has nearly nothing to do with you. Or you need to be not be thinking just like a herd mentality, collective mentality, to just work in someone's factory for and waste your life that way, actually, basically. And have a corporate raider steal your pension in the last year before you retire, and besides not be able to pay your rent and your mortgage and your whole thing, and just be a slave basically all your life. And so the introduction of the awareness of death is actually the beginning of true individualism in a society, not the fake one that America pretends to itself that we're all very individualistic, but actually we're highly conformist and very manipulable by bad leaders and so on. Very much have what the Societe Frankfurt School came up with about the Germans following the Nazis out of their desperate economic situation, the authoritarian personality, you know, willing to be following some idiot and throw your life in the under the bus driven by the idiot. Because you think about death and you say, no way, what am I doing with these moments of my life that at least benefit me, if not help many others? But at least benefit me. Why am I wasting my time doing this or that? You know, going down this or that tunnel. So it really does connect with a society that is confident enough, is open enough, possibly wealthy enough, to tolerate its and even desire its individuals to be really concerned with fulfilling themselves. And if the society basically wants the individuals to be enslaved to whatever its collective purpose is, they're not going to encourage them to think about death, because death is the great individual moment. You know, your family ties are gone, your possessions are gone, your status is gone. It's just you, and where are you, and what are you? And then, if you once you get that attitude, you become the dying live. Meaning, you're more and more alive because you realize you're dying. You're in the bardo of life between birth and death, right?
Do you see any cultures going in that direction?
Well, we are, I think. California is ahead of the East Coast until you came. But seriously, it is. We are doing that. And you know, like there was an article just the other day in some one of the papers, I think, I forget where I read it, or maybe The Economist, where some recruiter down in Georgia or someplace was going around with the journalist, you know, the reporter, and talking about meeting all kinds of people in some little village, very poor people who normally they would be recruiting like mad, you know, mostly blacks. And then they were very friendly with the recruiter, and he also had some goodies he gave them. But he said, they don't really join. They don't want to. They realize it's ridiculous, you know. And it's not really going to help them, you know. And they rather would hang out and make their best way in their poverty there and be free. And so I think it's become a big cultural thing that they can't mobilize people into these things, you know, very easily. It's very difficult. You know, there's no draft anymore. You know, there's no, where is the manpower and woman power? And it's not there, you know. And that's a good sign. And I think there's a worldwide resistance to all of this. In China, they have 350,000 to 400,000 extreme riots against the Communist Party every year. That's like 1,000 a day, if you add that up. And they have more money they spend suppressing than they do, although they probably hide some of their military expenditure. But they have more money trying to suppress the dissatisfaction of their own people, of their being coerced into slave labor, which is what it is. One Lama who came here in the 70s, the one I went with to the different Native American people as ambassador of Dalai Lama quietly, when he was leaving, he was in New York at a party by some very hip people, supposedly. And they asked him, Rinpoche, how do you like America, type thing? And he said, well, I enjoy it very much. It's a really nice country, and I had a nice time. He says, but it reminded me a little bit too much of communist China. He said, and people were horrified. And because this Lama had been in the 50s, he was in the party of the entourage of the Dalai Lama who went down in 54 for almost a year to try to cope with Mao and deal with the whole Chinese invasion and everything. And so he'd been all around in communist China. He'd seen things. And then people say, well, how can you say that? And all this thing. What? You know, this is our great individual land of the free and all this. Way. How can you say that? And he said, well, yes. He said, your houses are nicer. You have cars. You have the things, he said. But in both cases, nobody has any time at all. You all just work all the time. And like I've been staying in people's very kindly hosting me and wealthy houses, and the guy welcomes me, and then the guy has three phones in the house, and he's talking on all the time, and trading and doing things, and I'm there a week, and they never talk to me, because they have no time. And in communist China, 14 hours a day, they're out there catching the sparrows, doing the roads, working for the people, et cetera. I said, nobody had a minute of any freedom of time. He said, in Tibet, sometimes we worked very hard. In the villages, there was plowing in the farm villages. In the nomadic ones, they had to milk yaks and so on. And in the monasteries, we had exam time, and we had certain rituals. We had to prepare, do things. But there were a lot of time when we just, you know, said our prayers. We just hung out. The people didn't do anything. They sewed something. They did a little something. Hung out with each other. And it was, like, really pleasant in that way. And you people have no fun, he said.
Let's have fun.
This is the 70s, you know. Right. But I thought it was very, very thought-provoking, actually.
And the 70s was kind of a fun time compared to now.
Well, I don't know about that. Underpins. I mean, if you look at the mass, what's going on. Also, there's a great cartoon in here, in the New Yorker. It's a Times Square, you know, a Times Square thing.
Yeah.
And then all the signs are not selling this and that. One is saying, you're too fat. You're ugly. You're thirsty. You're hungry. You're very ugly. You're really fat. All the signs are saying that to people. Because they want them, their products going to help them be less so. You know?
I thought that was going to be another cartoon where there was a father and a son in Times Square, which was in a recent edition, and the son is looking at all the signs, and the father says, "This is going to count as part of your screen time today."
That's actually smart of the father. Okay.
There's actually a much more accessible book. Is the book called Paul Reps's book? What's this book about Zen? Zen Flesh, Zen Bones. And as part of that, he has many of the more usable verses from that tantra. So that might be the way to go. A book called Zen Flesh, Zen Bones, 10 ox herding pictures, Kashmiri Shaivite Tantrism. Lovely okay. book. So when we start talking about the book, does that throw us into a concept? Do we get caught in, oh, book, I need to get the book because I need to get from here to there? It's so hard not to do that, right?
Yes. Actually, what you say about pure perception without imposing concept is foundational in Tibetan epistemology. Indian, Dignaga, Dharmakirti, the great Indian logicians, they are sort of they preceded the Kantian discovery that the sort of basic material of sensations, he used the word intuition, actually. He didn't use the word perception, but sense intuition and intellectual intuition, meaning unmediated by a concept.
Right.
But usually, to most people, that's inaccessible because the concept happens so fast. So, but it's a beautiful thing, and it's a very sort of technical, epistemological way of connecting to that idea that ordinary experience, sort of unanalyzed and unrecognized even, is actually the enlightened experience that everyone has all the time but doesn't right. notice, because they only notice what they can grasp with a concept. So they express it in terms of when you see the wall, the white wall there, there's two things that you do. One, you see the white wall. The other one is you see the quote white, unquote, quote wall, unquote.
Right.
But most of us only see the quote white, unquote, we think. There's that first split second of just encountering it without recognizing what is its color or identifying it, in other words, is inaccessible to most of us, actually. But it would be a good thing to... There must be a way of trying to go at it. And to think that you're doing it without recognizing it. But it's not easy to do.
But it's good to notice how the concepts keep interfering.
Oh, yeah. Or even that, you know. Even that there's something underneath the concept, absolutely. Very interesting. Very interesting. The Shaiva Tantras particularly, and the Tibetan Tantras, which are the late Indian Tantras, they're very interconnected in Kashmir and Bengal, actually. From Indian history. And there's a whole story about it, but I don't want to go into that now. I thought actually it'd be more useful for people if we, in this morning, we did a couple, like one mild deity and one fierce deity together, and just do it as a meditative thing where we will go into meditation. We'll all be meditating it, imagining it, and we will hear the instructions from the friend. Oh, about the teacher, I wanted to say something about the teacher and the guru thing, because you mentioned about Hinduism and Buddhism. One thing about Buddhism is that in monastic Buddhism and in regular exoteric Buddhism, the guru role is very diminished, and the teacher model is a very nice one called Kalyanamitra, which means a virtuous friend. So the idea of the teacher is of rather a friend and a companion who may be a little more ahead of you or know something you don't or be able to help you with something, but they sort of try to deconstruct as much as possible the Indian patriarchal family idea of the authoritarian father, you know, which gets very much in the guru thing. As you know, the Sanskrit word guru's root meaning is heavy. Literally, guru means heavy. And, you know, like the father is heavy on the top of the family in the Indian patriarchal family. So Buddhism deconstructs that in regular study and teaching. But then in this advanced teaching, which they made esoteric, because people could misunderstand it, you know, if they were not really didn't have some preparatory cultivation. Then the guru thing comes back, the proper one should either channel or exemplify the state or the attainment that one wishes to gain. And even sometimes someone who is not themselves enlightened, if they are properly fitted within the tradition, they can serve as a kind of icon. Just like, you know, this is a statue of, we're still not sure, either Avalokiteshvara or Manjushri. And obviously we don't think that's Avalokiteshvara or Manjushri. But if someone uses that as a channel of the presence of Avalokiteshvara, compassion, Manjushri, wisdom, then it can have a usefulness. So similarly, the Lama figure or the Guru figure in Tantra, even someone who's not that enlightened themselves, if they have done the preparatory work, if they have the devotion themselves, if there's a chain of in back somewhere reaching an enlightened teacher, somewhere, it could be several generations back actually, then the student who is using that channel to try to contact the enlightened being, whether it's that immediate one they're facing or one further back, can use that being as an icon, so to speak. So and then the yoga of the student, the mental yoga of the student in that case, is to see that teacher in the initiatory setting as flawless, and all flaws are in the student's own perception. However, something which has not been much addressed, leading to much of the guru abuse in the West, and also people's feeling like, oh, I can't do anything, I don't have a guru, where's my guru? Sort of excessive kind of thing of like, it's like we're looking, needing the book, you know? It's like, well, I got to get the book, then I'll get somewhere. Or I got to find the guru, and then I'll get somewhere. This excessive thing that goes on, leading to the corruption of the gurus as well as the student, often, has to do with mixing that initiatory setting with the sort of day-to-day interaction. Like the Tibetans have a great proverb. They say the best lama, the best guru, and lama translates guru, but it adds something to the translation. I'll come back to that. But the best lama or the best guru is one who lives at least three valleys away. That's one of the things. And three valleys in Tibet is a big deal with a very high pass and a slow pony or yak or somebody or two-footed walking. It's not easy to get over to that three valleys. So you don't deal with the daily flaws and things about the lama, and you don't get involved in judging is he enlightened or she enlightened or not. You think of that one as your channel toward enlightenment, and then you work on yourself. And you don't have to, but then in the setting in the West where they come and they found a Dharma center and there was somebody's the secretary and somebody's the accountant and somebody else, you know, like registers the Rolls Royces and whatever, you know, it can get really ridiculous, you know. Where then the yoga of seeing no flaw in the guru has to be imposed on a guru who daily is manifesting a lot of flaws and behaving badly, actually. And then it's supposed to be like enlightened, so then everybody has to like keep saying no, 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 and then being, since we're all Americans, building up intense resentment, and then you have explosive events, right, where they then turn hating. And also, if one has had a bad guru, in other words, you learned something, you had some good times, you developed somewhat, and then the guy got out of hand and started really bothering people, then everybody turns on them and ejects them from the universe and then hates them, that's really bad for you. You can dissociate yourself from a guru who has behaved badly and say, I no longer can go with you, and I'm not going to like listen to you. You're no longer a good channel for me. But thank you for what you did channel when you were not, when your misbehavior was not what was not interfering with your being a channel for there being some sort of enlightenment. So that way then I can continue on the path. One doesn't turn against the whole thing, as often happens in these settings. So the guru thing is very, but what I love is the Tibetan translation of the word guru, which they did not translate with the Tibetan word for heavy. They translated it as lama. And lama means that which you can't get beyond. Doesn't mean that which is above you, higher than you. So I always like to say, the lama figure in the Tibetan should be really the model of a tar baby, rather than the model of something high above you that you're supposed to like grovel to, you know? In other words, it's something you can't get past. You know, you get stuck on, you know, like where you grab the tar baby, you know, and then you can't let go of it. That's what, the lama has that different connotation, you know. And also it's nice in that it relates to ama, mother, you know, lama, mama, you know, it's very, it has a nice, Tibetans didn't do these refinements because Tibetans, for all their backwardness at the start, you know, being a conquest dynasty of really rough people, yak herding, wild people, you know. But the Siddhas all went up there, you know, the Maharajis of that time, and the Dalai Lamas and Karmapas of that time, they all went up there ahead of time because they foresaw the Islamic event coming into India and the vulnerability of India having become more gentle over 1,000 years. And they really worked them over. And then it became the mainstream thing, and they completely demilitarized. It took time, but they completely became vulnerable, as we've seen in this recent century. They got completely trampled, you know, totally. Which the original version of that was the Shakya kingdom of Shakyamuni. I don't know if you know that story, but so many of the young warriors in Shakyamuni's city-state joined him and as mendicants and got into the thing that there was no one to defend the country, and they got completely wasted in his lifetime.
Wow.
So that is the, and that, don't be discouraged about that. The Buddhification, let's call it, not the Buddhist religionization, but the Buddhification of a culture which makes it more gentle and more vulnerable and more sensitive and makes life more pleasant for the people in the subculture, you know, now is something that all the cultures on the planet have to do or we won't survive. There's now nobody can conquer you, you know, basically. It's not possible.
Greetings and salutations, podcast wallahs. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. This episode was originally recorded at the Death and Deathlessness Retreat with Dale Borgram of the Living and Dying Project, held at Menla and Dewa Spa in the heart of the Catskills in October 2015. This recording comes from the retreat where Bob and Dale taught together for the first time on the Tibetan Book of the Dead. It was a great retreat, and if you're inspired by what you hear in this podcast episode, be sure to visit the Tibet House US membership archives on YouTube and at tibethouse.us to watch more recordings from this program. As we heard in the first half of this episode, Bob gave the history and spiritual context of the Tibetan Book of the Dead and the interesting history behind its mistitling. Going forward, for reference and for web ease, we refer to it as the Tibetan Book of the Dead. But as Bob explains in this week's episode, it's not the title at all. If you're looking to dig deeper into the topic of a Tibetan Book of the Dead, with air quotes, be sure to listen to past episodes of the Bob Thurman Podcast. There are several from past retreats and teachings with Robert Thurman and friends, including ones with Mark Epstein, Sharon Salzberg, Dr. Nita, Richard Freeman, Mary Taylor, and other yoga teachers from the annual Buddha and the Yogis program. Bob and Sharon Salzberg will also be touching on the subject at the annual Dharma and Meditation New Year's Retreat held at Menla in the heart of the Catskills in Phoenicia, New York each year. To learn more about this annual program, be sure to visit menla.us. Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House US membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, including special invites to VIP fundraising events, including the annual benefit auction happening December 10th at Tibet House in New York City, please visit tibethouse.us. Your monthly support and online participation helps Tibet House's mission to present and preserve Tibetan culture. Please be sure to like, comment, share, and post about this podcast on your favorite social media platform. And as always, weekly interstitial music for the Bob Thurman podcast is provided by 'Tenzin Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more about 'Tenzin Chogyal, please visit his website at tenzinchogyal.com. And now, back to Gary and Bob for the second half of this week's podcast.
So anyway, okay, I'm sorry, that's just a footnote about Hinduism and Buddhism.
Thank you.
Okay, so you should, let's go now. We're going to do the first day. We started this, I read it to you, where you enter the mild deity reality between, because naughty, naughty, you didn't recognize the mother reality of the objective clear light, the actual transparency of ultimate reality directly experienced beyond the subject-object dichotomy, called mother because of her being the matrix of all possibility. So we missed that. We crawled beyond it. And now we have a chance to get back to it through an icon. And so we meet the Mile deities, which are depicted in that painting behind him, one version of depiction of it, from this tantra. And I read that to you before. Hey, noble one. So now think that you are either reading this to a person who has departed, they're already gone, you're sitting next to the dead body, or you yourself have left your body and you're in a state and you hear someone you're listening to read this and you're trying to concentrate on it. You're mobilizing all the concentration power you developed in life to not get distracted by all the swirling, zooming, subtle dream world of the between. And you're listening to this. Okay, so that's it. Let's meditate this now. Hey, noble one, son or daughter, listen unwavering with intense concentration. There are six kinds of between: the natural life between, the dream between, the contemplation between, the death point between, the reality between, and the emergent existence between. I already explained those. Hey, noble one, three betweens will dawn for you: the death point between, the reality between, and the existence between will dawn. Until yesterday, in the death point between, the reality clear light dawned. But you did not recognize it, so you had to wander here. Now the reality between and the existence between will dawn for you. As I describe them, you must recognize them without fail. This is now, and then if you have done lucid dreaming, which there's been some talk about, then you will maybe be able to recognize yourself in the dreamlike state of the between. The dream state that we get into every night is an immensely valuable arena of learning if you really take the focus to do that. And we should really have more retreats on that. Hey, noble one, now you have arrived at what is called death. You are going from this world to the world beyond. You are not alone. It happens to everyone. You must not indulge in attachment and insistence on this life. Though you are attached and you insist, you have no power to stay. You will not avoid wandering in the life cycle. Do not lust. Do not cling. Be mindful of the three jewels, the teacher, the teaching and the reality taught, and the community of those implementing the teaching. Hey, noble child, Whatever terrifying visions of the reality between may dawn upon you, you should not forget the following words. You must proceed remembering in your mind the meaning of these words. Therein lies the key of recognition. Hey, now when the reality between dawns upon me, I will let go of the hallucinations of instinctive terror. Enter the recognition of all objects as my mind's own visions, and understand this as the pattern of perception in the between. Come to this moment, arrived at this most critical cessation. I will not fear my own visions of deities, mild and fierce. You should proceed clearly, saying this verse aloud and remembering its meaning. Do not forget this, as it is the key to recognizing whatever terrifying visions dawn as certainly being your own perceptions. Hey, noble one, at this time when your mind and body are parting ways, pure reality manifests in subtle, dazzling visions, vividly experienced, naturally frightening and worrisome, shimmering like a mirage on the plains in autumn. Do not fear them. Do not be terrified. Do not panic. You have what is called an instinctual mental body, not a material flesh and blood body. Thus, whatever sounds, lights, and rays may come at you, they cannot hurt you. You cannot die. It is just enough for you to recognize them as your own perceptions. Understand that this is the between. Hey, noble one. If you don't recognize them as your own perceptions in this way, whatever other meditations and achievements you may have experienced in the human world, if you did not meet this particular instruction, the lights will frighten you, the sounds will panic you, the rays will terrify you. If you don't know the key of this instruction, you will not recognize the sounds, lights, and rays, and you will wander in the life cycle. Hey, noble one, having fainted for 4.5 days, that's in the clear light, but possibly in the case of some only experienced or remembered as a, and recognized as a state of unconsciousness. Having fainted for 4.5 days, you are now proceeding. You have woken up with the worry, what is happening to me? Recognize that you are in the between. Now, since the life cycle is in suspension, all things dawn as lights and deities. All space dawns full of azure light. Now from the central Buddha land, the all-pervading drop, the Lord Vairochana appears before you, white-bodied, sitting on a lion throne, holding in his hand an 8-spoked wheel, united with his consort Akasha Datta Ishvari as the central figure in that painting, that white one. Akasha Datta Ishvari means the queen of the realm of space. The natural purity of the consciousness aggregate, that is your heap of cognitions, the blue light of the reality perfection wisdom, a clear and vivid color blue, frighteningly intense, shines piercingly from the heart center of this Vairochana couple, dazzling your eyes to an unbearable degree. Simultaneously, the soft white light of the gods shines upon you and penetrates you in parallel with the bright blue light. At that time, influenced by negative evolutionary momentum, you panic and are terrified of that bright blue light of reality, perfection, wisdom, and you flee from it. And you feel a liking for the soft white light of the gods and you approach it. But you must not panic at that blue light, the clear, piercing, brilliant, frightening, supreme wisdom, clear light. Do not fear it. It is the light ray of the transcendent Lord, the reality, perfection, wisdom. Feel attracted to it with faith and reverence. Make it the answer to your prayer, thinking. It is the light ray of the compassion of Lord Vairochana. I must take refuge in it. It is the way Lord Vairochana comes to escort you through the straits of the between. It is the light ray of the compassion of Vairochana. Don't be enticed by the soft white light of the gods. Don't be attached to it. Don't long for it. If you do cling to it, you will wander into the realm of the gods, and you will continue to cycle through the six realms of driven existence. It is an obstacle to cessation, the path of freedom. So don't look upon it, but be devoted to the brilliant, penetrating blue light. Aim your intense willpower toward Vairochana, and repeat after me the following prayer. Why don't you repeat like you're a ghost? When I roam the life cycle,
when I roam the life cycle,
driven by strong delusion,
driven by strong delusions,
may the Lord Vairochana,
may the Lord Vairochana,
lead me on the path,
lead me on the path
of the clear light,
of the clear light
of reality, perfection, wisdom,
of reality, perfection, wisdom.
May his consort Buddha,
may his consort Buddha,
Dhatishvari,
Aishwari,
back me on the way.
Back me on the way.
Deliver me from the dangerous.
Deliver me from the dangerous.
Straits of the between.
Straits of the between.
And carry me.
And carry me.
To perfect Buddhahood.
To perfect Buddhahood.
Thus praying with fierce devotion, you dissolve in rainbow light into the heart of the Vairochana couple, whence you will enter the central pure land, Ganavyuha, dense array, and become a Buddha by way of the body of perfect beatitude. So that's called the first day. And therefore, that from that comes the general advice, which could be used by the living, dying people. Like, whatever happens to you, always go to the strobe light, go to the bright light. Never go to the seemingly the seductive light. Go to the one that wipes you out. And give yourself over to it, type of thing. Always the safest way. And then there are five other days which we won't read. We won't meditate, although maybe another time we could do more of this. It's kind of very funny, very interesting. And dealing with Akshobhya and Amitabha and Amoghasiddhi. And these are these celestial Buddhas who are mounted on the five wisdoms, what I call the five, or rather I like to call them the five intuitions or intuitive wisdoms, which actually are the five addictive emotions and notions converted into these five intuitive wisdoms, which is the role, which is the job of Tantra, but which is difficult. But maybe we'll do this, the Vajrasattva one, which is the sixth day, because it says something very beautiful in it, which I think if you meditate, you'll get the, and I'll skip some of it. Okay, hey, noble one. Okay, back to meditating now. Did you stretch a little in between? I hope. Okay, now back to meditating. Hey, no, this is the sixth day. The other ones are different colors, you know. And each brilliant color, you know, white, yellow, green, etc., goes along with the soft color, luring you to the animal realm, the human realm, the preta realm, the hell realm, the one connected with hatred, transmutation of hatred will lead to the hell realm, etc. And the titan realm, jealousy leads you there. But they each have a seductive light coming next to the brilliant light. And each time you have a chance to go through the heart of that Buddha couple, you know, which is very interesting. It's very parallel to how the science of the between state describes when you, if you go back into a mammal or human realm, how you go into the couple of your parents in the same way. In other words, you are this wandering dream being, and you enter into the heart of the parents, and then end up in the womb of the mother, you know, and that way become conceived. So the conception involves the meeting of three seeds, three genes, not just two, but three. Okay, anyway, back to sixth day. Hey, noble one, back to meditate. Listen without wavering. Up until yesterday, the visions of the five Buddha clans appeared to you one by one. Though they were clearly described, under the influence of negative evolutionary momentum, you were panicked, and still up to now you are left behind here. If you had already recognized the natural shining of one of the wisdoms of the five clans as your own visions, it would have caused you to dissolve into rainbow light in the body of one of the five Buddha clans and to attain Buddhahood in the body of beatitude. As it is, you did not recognize the light and you are still wandering here. Now, behold without distraction. Now, the vision of all the five clans and the vision of the joining of the four wisdoms have come to escort you in their direction. Recognize them. Hey, noble child, the purity of the four elements is dawning as the four lights. In the center, the Vairochana Buddha couple, as described above, appears from the Pure Land all-pervading drop. In the east, the Vajrasattva Buddha couple. In the south, the Ratnasambhava Buddha couple. In the west, the Amitabha Buddha couple. In the north, the Amoghasiddhi Buddha couple. And then he lists some other protectors and other beings in each of the five clans, which we can skip. Hey, noble one, those pure lands are not anywhere else. They abide in your own heart, within its center and four directions. They now emerge from out of your heart and appear to you as if external realities. Those images do not come from anywhere else. They are primordially created as the natural manifestation of your own awareness. So you should know how to recognize them. Hey, noble one, those deities, not great, not small, symmetrical, each with ornamentation, color, posture, throne, and gesture, those deities, each pervaded by five mantras, each of the five circled by a five-colored rainbow aura, with male bodhisattvas of each clan upholding the male part and female bodhisattvas of each clan upholding the female part, with all the mandalas arising simultaneously whole. They are your archetype deities, so you should recognize them. Hey, noble one, from the hearts of those five Buddha clan couples, four combined wisdom light rays dawn in your heart center, each extremely subtle and clear, like sun rays woven together in a rope. Now first from Vairochana's heart center, a cloth of the frighteningly brilliant white light rays of the reality perfection wisdom dawns connecting to your heart center. Within that light ray cloth, white drops glisten with their rays like mirrors facing toward you, very clear, brilliant, and awesomely penetrating, with each drop itself naturally adorned with five other drops. Thus, that light ray cloth is adorned with shining drops and droplets without limit or center. From the heart of Vajrasattva, the mirror wisdom, a cloth of blue light rays, shines brilliantly upon you, connecting to your heart center, on which shining blue drops, like turquoise bowls facing down toward you, adorned by other drops and droplets, all shine upon you. From the heart of Ratnasambhava, a cloth of the equalizing wisdom, yellow light rays, shines brilliantly upon you, on which golden drops, like golden bowls, adorned by other golden drops and droplets, face down and dawn upon you. From the heart center of Amitabha, the discriminating wisdom, red light cloth, shines brilliantly upon you, on which radiant red drops, like coral bowls, facing down to you, endowed with the deep luster of wisdom, very bright and penetrating, each adorned by five natural red drops. All these shine upon you, adorned by drops and droplets without center or limit. These also shine upon you, connecting to your heart center. Hey, Noble One, these all arise from the natural exercise of your own awareness. They do not come from anywhere else. So do not be attached to them and do not be terrified of them. Relax in the experience of non-conceptualization. Within that experience, all the deities and light rays will dissolve into you and you will become a Buddha. Hey, Noble One, since the exercise of the wisdom of your awareness is not perfected, the all-accomplishing wisdom's green light does not shine. Emerald light. Hey, Noble One, these are called the vision of the four wisdoms in combination, the inner passageway of Vajrasattva. That means the diamond hero. At that time, you should remember the orientation previously given by your spiritual teacher. If you remember that orientation, you will trust those visions. You will recognize reality like the child meeting the mother, or like the greeting of a long familiar person, and you will cease all reifying notions. Recognizing your visions as your own creations, you will trust your being held on the changeless path of pure reality, and you will achieve the samadhi of continuity. Your awareness will dissolve into the body of great effortlessness, and you will become a Buddha in the beatific body, never to be reversed. Hey, Noble One, along with the wisdom lights, but before I do that, just reflect now on this twisted rainbow of rainbow rope, it's like a cloth, path of cloth, and yet it's woven into a rope-like cloth connecting from your actual heart center of your utmost identity into the mandalic hearts of all of those four Buddhas. So that it's not a matter of you having to recognize and go into the heart of like Vairochana or some deity seen as an object in front of you, but rather it's automatically, you're totally connected to all of their heart centers, to all this vivid, dazzling white, blue, red, and yellow, golden, shining, sort of liquid laser light drop cloth-like rays. And they therefore effortlessly pull you, your entire being, into merging into the mandala and becoming one with those divine beings, and becoming such a divine being yourself. It's like the Buddhas couldn't invite you into their hearts and their pure lands to become a Buddha in the previous 5 days. So now they offer to you this lifeline. They throw to you this lifeline, which connects to the center of you. So in a way, there's almost no need to choose to connect to it. It's close to being automatically pulled in by like a tractor beam, like this brilliant rainbow tractor beam, going right to your own heart center. That's really... Hey, noble one, but then there's a warning. Hey, noble one, along with the wisdom lights, there also arise the impure, misleading visions of the six species, namely the soft white light of the gods, the soft red light of the titans, the soft blue light of the humans, the soft green light of the animals, the soft yellow light of the pretans, and the soft smoky light of the hells. These six arise entwined in parallel with the pure wisdom lights. They're like a sort of aura around them of more seductive, easy to look at things, not dazzling. Therefore, don't seize or cling to any of those lights. Relax in the experience of non-perception. If you fear the wisdom lights and cling to the impure six species life cycle lights, you will assume the body of a being of one of the six species. You will not reach the time of liberation from the great ocean of suffering of the life cycle. You will experience only trouble. Hey, noble one, if you lack the orientation given in the instruction of the spiritual teacher, and you fear and are terrified by the above images and the pure, dazzling wisdom lights, you will come to cling to the impure life cycle lights. Do not do so. Have faith in those dazzling, piercing, pure wisdom lights. Trust in them, thinking, these light rays of the wisdom of the compassion of the blissful lords of the five clans have come to me to hold me with compassion. I must take refuge in them. Not clinging, not longing for the misleading lights of the six species, you aim your will one-pointedly toward the five Buddha clan couples and make the following prayer. Hey, when I roam the life cycle driven by the five strong poisons, may the Lord victors of the five clans lead me on the path of the clear light of the four wisdoms in combination. May the supreme five consort Buddhas back me on the way and deliver me from the impure lights of the six realms. Delivering me from the dangerous straits of the between, may they carry me to the five supreme Buddha lands. Then on the seventh day, there are these scientist deities. And my Tibetan translator colleagues really freaked about my translation of Vidyadhara, a scientist, which literally means holder of science. So they really freaked because these guys have long matted locks. They're wearing like jock straps. They have like bone ornaments. And they're like scientists in downtime back in Berkeley in their garden. They're not wearing the white coat in the lab and stuff. So because scientists all wear white coats and they have mirrors on their head and they're in the lab. And you can't say these are scientists.
And not in California.
So it's really, you know, so that's why, you see, I wanted to have, thank you, at ease, stretch. I wanted so much to get, you know, ILM, when George Lucas still owned it, I begged him. I happened to have been acquaintance, and I begged and begged, and he didn't get what I was wanting. I had, to make really vivid, dazzling light ray, you know, videos. You know, they think they can do with incredible colors on these things, you know. And then, you know, play them. And they don't have to have this kind of deity. They can have Jesus or Mother Mary holding a baby. They can have whatever people. You have different varieties for different people from different cultural backgrounds. And the Mexicans would sort of like the skeleton thing. They have these Day of the Dead. They have really great, you know, vision, you know, like imagery. But other people would have different things. And then you have 20 minutes in a can, in a DVD. You play on a projector in a hospice. For people, and just, you know, like, this is kind of fun. Go and see this, like a roller coaster. You go check it out, and then people get into it, and they watch it, very vivid, very powerful, and then they have the around the screen, you know, you have the soft lights, you know, and then you say, like, try to focus as much as you can on the center, and then it goes by them, you know. And this would be awesome subliminal perceptual training for people, for their tunnel or their whatever it is, you know, it really, you know, it, seriously,
Yeah, I know. Now
living, dying, you can get it. Then you can market that. Then you'll be out of the market once everybody can just play it. But, you know, it'll be a good market for a while.
But now they even have the virtual reality where it's not just on the screen,
exactly.
but you're in it.
Yes. That's it. Google, better, maybe
let's go into business.
We will. I talked to Google, but they don't listen to religion professors. They don't listen to professors.
A poem by Muriel Rukeyser, who lived from 1913 to 1980, an American poet. In it, toward the end, she evokes awakening, the root meaning of Bud, to awaken. I lived in the first century of world wars. Most mornings I would be more or less insane. The newspapers would arrive with their careless stories. The news would pour out of various devices, interrupted by attempts to sell products to the unseen. I would call my friends on other devices. They would be more or less mad for similar reasons. Slowly I would get to pen and paper, make my poems for others unseen and unborn. In the day I would be reminded of those men and women, brave, setting up signals across vast distances, considering a nameless way of living, of almost unimagined values. As the lights darkened, as the lights of night brightened, we would try to imagine them, try to find each other, to construct peace, to make love, to reconcile waking with sleeping, ourselves with each other, ourselves with ourselves. We would try by any means to reach the limits of ourselves, to reach beyond ourselves, to let go the means, to wake. I lived in the first century of these wars. I'm Gary Gawk, and this poetry segment is a part of the Bob Thurman Podcast and is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives License. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal. May all beings